Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Charlotte Donlin is the author of The Great Belonging, How Loneliness Leads Us to Each Other. She's a writer, a spiritual director, and host of the Hope for the Lonely podcast. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, Catapult, The Millions, Mockingbird, and elsewhere. She and her husband live in Birmingham, Alabama, with their two teenage children. Charlotte Donlin, thank you so much for being on the Habit Podcast this morning.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You know, one of the big ideas in your new book, The Great Belonging, is the gifts that come with loneliness. And you say that loneliness is not something to be fixed, but a companion to listen to. So when you listen to loneliness, what is it that you hear, Charlotte?
Well, when I listen to my loneliness, I hear stories, stories that I'm a part of, stories that have formed me, stories of isolation and loneliness, but also stories of belonging. I think that when we look closer at our loneliness or acknowledge it and, you know, explore how it might be a part of our lives, how different forms of loneliness might be a part of our lives, I think it moves us closer toward belonging and helps us think more about the ways that we belong to ourselves, to each other, and to God.
And why is that? Why is it that thinking about our own loneliness points us to our belonging? What do you mean when you say that?
I think the best way to explain that is to, you know, how people say that experiencing sorrow helps us experience joy. And when we, you know, accept sorrow and instead of denying it or, you know, and even grief and lament, like, when we move deeper into those things, I think we're able to experience more joy. And I think loneliness and belonging, it's a similar kind of dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are, you've sort of touched on this already, but what are some gifts that loneliness gives us? I mean, as you said, it helps us make sense of, or you know, be more aware of where we do belong. What are some other gifts? You've done a lot of thinking about loneliness.
The gifts come with regard to belonging. What that means to me is having more meaningful relationships. So, when I'm able to be honest about my loneliness and share that with a friend, yeah, we'll talk about loneliness and we'll say, yeah, me too. I know what you're talking about. But then we also move into deeper, subjects, you know, other subjects and other ideas and other ways to relate to each other, because that window has been opened and we've been vulnerable about something that a lot of people aren't always really, you know, open to talking about. A lot of people are ashamed of their loneliness, and a lot of people didn't even know that what they're experiencing is a form of loneliness. So I think, you know, the gifts of relationship, the gifts of our intimacy with God, when I've recognized that God is with me, even in the midst of feeling very alone, I've received grace and love from God in ways that I hadn't before. Uh-huh. You know, God will never leave you or forsake you takes on a whole new meaning when you feel like left and forsaken by in other ways, you know.
Yeah.
And I do think loneliness opens our eyes to the world around us. I think it helps us give attention to those we might encounter who are also lonely. So I think it helps us pay more attention, kind of be more welcoming and hospitable to others in their loneliness. And even just the natural world, like I did some research on place attachment and I write about place in the book a bit, but I don't think I use the words place attachment, but there is like research and study on how we're attached to our places. And recognizing our loneliness helps us see the other ways we're attached in the ways that like help us feel less lonely. I think even with the pandemic, you know, a lot of us have been stuck at home and quarantined, and, you know, a lot of people in my neighborhood were out walking more. And, you know, my husband and I even kind of made up stories about neighbors we'd never seen before, but kept seeing every day on their walks, like neighbor fan fiction of some sort. But, I think one reason, like, I think we might have been even more lonely if we weren't walking in our neighborhoods and attaching to those places in ways that we hadn't before.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense. But
did you get to know more neighbors through the quarantine time?
We got to know our neighbors. We live in a condo here. We're I mean, most people that live here are kind of in the retirement phase of their lives, and we love it. It's wonderful to not have to take care of a yard and that kind of thing. So we've gotten to know some of the people here a little bit better. Mm-hmm. The people that we've made up stories about, you know, it's hard because no one wants to approach anyone because of germs and droplets. But we kind of like nod to the people that we see all the time. And I'm hoping that maybe after some of this passes, I can say real words to some of these people that I keep seeing.
You make me think about, you're talking about that. It reminds me of an idea that you wrote about in your book. And that is the buddy bench or the chat bench.
Yeah. Yes.
Tell us about it. I love that idea. So tell us about the buddy bench or the chat bench.
Yeah, there in that chapter, there are two different takes on the bench for people to sit at and talk to others. The second graders in Ohio called it buddy benches. And they, I want to say during PE or, you know, when they're playing outside, they noticed that some kids would kind of pull off to the periphery and stand alone and look like they kind of were sad or left out. And so they asked the principal if they could add a bench or maybe designate a bench that was already there as the buddy bench. So if you see someone sitting there, you know that that person wants to talk to someone, might be feeling sad or lonely. Mm-hmm. And the other one was the, what did you call it?
The chat bench.
So a policeman in London, I think, noticed that several of the residents in his area, especially the elderly residents, were very lonely, and it even put them at risk for being taken advantage of by, you know, people preying on them, wanting money from them and that kind of thing. And, you know, they would gladly talk to a stranger trying to take thousands of dollars from them because they were so lonely. So he had the idea of designating some benches in the local parks or green spaces as happy to chat benches. And it's the same concept as the second graders, except, you know, it's just people walking in a park. But if you see someone, if you want to talk to someone, a stranger, and connect with someone, you can sit on the bench. And if you see someone on the bench, you are welcome to join them. And I think what it does is it gives people permission to say, you know, I'm lonely and I kind of want to talk to somebody, even if I don't know you real well and we may only chit chat about surfacey things. Mm-hmm. That would be a good thing right now. And, you know, maybe we might even talk about something more meaningful than surfacey chit chat also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love the idea of saying, you know, designating a place for strangers to talk to one another.
Yeah.
And to tell a little story or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
That it just seems like when you talk to strangers, your chances of a interesting story happening are actually pretty high.
You know? Yeah, they are. It's like, I know when I meet a stranger and, you know, you make that first quick connection about something you might have in common. And I think I am more willing to just kind of tell a story about, you know, something kind of crazy because I know that I won't see them again, or I want to make an impression, or maybe just connect over a story. You know, there's power in stories. And I think that's one reason that, you know, when I say it's important to talk about our loneliness, I think, and this is kind of getting away from the chat mentioned strangers, but what I mean by that is I want us to tell stories about our loneliness. You know, I want us to like not just say, oh, I'm lonely, but, you know, when we tell stories about things, we are recognizing and placing ourselves within the larger story. We're taking part in the stories that are around us and the stories that have shaped us and the stories that we're shaping for ourselves and others.
Yeah. So what is the connection between loneliness and finding our place in these stories? Can you tell me about that?
My primary idea of connecting loneliness to stories is kind of rooted in this quote I read this morning from Eugene Peterson, and it's from his book, Eat This Book, A Conversation in the Art of Spiritual Reading. Mm-hmm. And he basically talks about how story is, you know, kind of the main thing. The Holy Scriptures are story shaped. This is a quote from Peterson. The Holy Scriptures are story-shaped. Reality is story-shaped. The world is story-shaped. Our lives are story-shaped. And then he goes on to say, we enter the story following the story-making, storytelling Jesus, and spend the rest of our lives exploring the amazing and exquisite details, the words and sentences that go into the making of the story of our creation, salvation, and life of blessing. And then he talks about how there are a lot of connections and invisible things. So imagination is required with that. And when I think about loneliness as, you know, a part of our stories, it kind of normalizes it because, you know, when you think about everything that creates stories, I mean, it's, for me, it's a lot of ordinary things, you know, stories happen in the ordinary. There are, you know, fantastical and extraordinary things too, but I think most of our stories are very ordinary stories.
Yeah.
And so normalizing loneliness helps it feel not as scary. And I think stories help me normalize it and help me view it as just, okay, this is something else that's a part of my story and the larger story and all of our stories, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's as if one way of thinking about loneliness is feeling like I'm somehow being left out of a story, and to, you know, to recognize this is part of the story too is pretty helpful.
Yes, definitely. And you know, a friend emailed me this morning actually, and he's like, he's a poet, and he said, I've been working on these poems, and I was talking to two of our friends from the MFA program we were in. And he said, I realized all these poems are kind of about loneliness. He said, and in fact, I think they're about my loneliness and my dad's loneliness. And he asked if I had given much thought to this and with my writing and research, and he hadn't read my book yet. And I did send him the digital arc after I read the book, because I do talk about my mom's loneliness and my daughter's loneliness. And not that the fact that we're all lonely, like, helps our loneliness go away. It doesn't help it go away, but it helps us feel less lonely in our loneliness. So yeah, I think like making that connection that others are experiencing the same thing or having these same sorts of stories is helpful.
I want to circle back, and this is something you said early in this conversation. You mentioned that we feel ashamed of loneliness. What do you see as the connection between loneliness and shame?
Well, in the research I did, there was, I think this was the very large study that was done in 2018, and which kind of started all of the news stories and chitter chatter about loneliness in America. That Cigna study, I think. But one thing that was discovered is that people feel ashamed of their own loneliness, but they don't judge others who are lonely. Huh. So it's like, I'll let other people be lonely and that's fine, but there's just a lot of self-judgment with it. And, you know, I think shame and vulnerability are connected. When we're afraid to be vulnerable and honest about our feelings, the shame kind of grows. So, again, that's why I want people to talk about their loneliness, you know, not with people who aren't safe, but with people you trust and people who will respond in ways that are helpful, because it takes away the shame. You know, once we speak it, the shame kind of dissipates and the power loneliness has over us decreases, at least in my experience. And I hope that that's true for others.
Yeah. I think I love that insight that things we feel shame about for ourselves, we don't judge. I mean, there certainly are. Right. Things. I'm not saying that's true across the board, but there are, you know, in our own, we feel shame in our own struggles. And it's like, but if somebody else is struggling, we don't think they're losers. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is a weird kind of dynamic, but I think it's true for things other than loneliness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, this is a podcast about writing, not loneliness per se. So, tell me about your, I mean, you're a writer, you're a writer who has done a lot of thinking about loneliness. So let's talk about the relationship between loneliness and the writing life. I mean, does writing ease your loneliness? Does it, the floor is open. So
writing definitely eases my loneliness. One way is through reading. So I think all writers should be reading, and that writers are also readers. And when I read, whether it's, you know, nonfiction or a novel or a poem, that kind of strikes something in me where I feel like I'm seen and known. That helps me feel less lonely, you know, as a reader. And then that also usually inspires me to write. Or that's the same kind of thing that inspires me to write, because I want readers to feel less alone in this life, and not just with regard to loneliness, but, you know, with other things I write. You know, I've written a lot about mental illness and my experiences with mental illness. And when readers respond and email me and say, wow, thank you for being open about this and honest about this, I think it helps all of us feel more seen and known. And then just my own personal process of writing helps me feel less alone with regard to my spiritual life. And I know this might sound kind of woo-woo to some people, but I do see my writing life as a form of prayer. And not that it's super spiritual all the time, but there are, you know, moments or minutes or hours where it feels very much like God and I are in this together. Mm-hmm. And it can be very prayerful. And, you know, I'm not saying it's like that all the time, but as a whole, I do see my writing as a part of my larger vocation that, you know, is connected to the Spirit and how the Spirit moves in me, and helps me notice the things around me. But I do think overall the life of a writer is a lonely life. we have these things in our heads that we can't get out, or I do, you know, I have so much in my head that I can't really tell anyone, but when I write it, it helps me, it might actually be a way of knowing myself more and belonging more to myself as I process, a new idea or something I'm pondering or even something I might be feeling. I haven't thought about this now until I'm talking about this, but maybe it is belonging to myself more as I write, whether it's journaling or a new essay or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen the essay that Jennifer Trafton wrote. It's called All the Lonely Writers. And she talks about, she quotes, I guess it's Whitman, talking about the spiders who kind of fling out their threads, hoping that they'll catch something, and that's what it's like to be a writer, you know, to fling these things out there that maybe will connect with somebody and make them feel a little less lonely, make me feel a little less lonely.
Yeah, and I think I have read that essay, actually, and my daughter took a class from her, I think, a writing class. But it also kind of reminds me of social media. And I know, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with social media, but I think that's what a lot of us are doing, is throwing those, strings out and hoping someone will see and, you know, validate us. And, whether right or wrong, we want to be seen and known and heard and even just connect with someone in a small way of, like, you know, liking my Instagram posts and making a comment about, oh yeah, I feel that way too. So
another thing that seems really relevant to the writer that you mentioned in your book, The Great Belonging, is that somebody once told you, I guess you were asking, how do I connect? How do I be less lonely, or whatever y'all were talking about, is somebody who come to some teacher who'd come to your church or something. This person told you, to give others what you want and need. And that seems to me really relevant to the question of, how do I know what readers need, or how do I serve the reader? Start by giving what you need.
Yeah. And I think when I first asked that question, it was about friendships and wanting, more meaningful friendships and deeper friendships. And he said, you need to give others what you want and be that deeper friend. But with regard to writing, I mean, a lot of people say, write the book that you want to read, that's not out there. And I think that's what happened with this book. I wanted to read about loneliness in a way that wasn't formulaic or, 10 steps to be less lonely, that acknowledged the nuance of loneliness and that there are different forms of it. And we all experience it differently. And we have different seasons where we experience it differently. So I wanted that and couldn't find it. So I decided, I'm going to try to write this and maybe others will like it and read it and find it helpful. I also think with the writing life, there are other ways to do this. We want to be, I think we want to have conversations about our writing or to hear from others. So I try to, if I love an essay or a book or whatever, I try to reach out to the author, not in an annoying way, and tell them thank you, or, tweet about it, or, try to tell others, recommend it in my newsletter to people. So I think being a part of the literary community is another way that kind of allows us to be to others what we long for others to be to us.
Yeah, that's great.
And not in a manipulative way. Like, it could sound really manipulative, like, oh, I'm going to give you this, so you'll give it to me. And that's not what this theologian meant when he told me this, and that's not my approach. It's more of like a posture of generosity. Happening.
Yeah. I feel like I'm really bad at guessing what other people might want or like, or, you know, all I know is what I like, and I know what jokes I think are funny. And that, so I try to tell those jokes, right? I mean, especially when you see somebody writing kids' books, telling jokes that they think kids will think are funny, but they don't think are funny. It's like, it's just terrible. I hate reading that stuff.
Yeah. It feels awkward. Really? You really think this?
I just think that's another, this is so relevant to questions of loneliness and so relevant to questions of writing. I mean, writing's never just about writing, and it's always about something else. Yeah. The other huge insight from your book that I think is extremely important is this reminder that we're always going to be a little lonely in this world. And that loneliness is pointing us to longings that this world can't fulfill.
Yeah.
In C.S. Lewis, it's known as the argument from desire. that longing for something that the world can't fulfill suggests that there's something beyond the world that will fulfill our desires.
Yeah.
As you say, and I think there's take some courage to say some of the things you said in this book. And you talk about your own loneliness in marriage, which just doesn't mean, I mean, you're talking about loneliness in a good marriage, not loneliness in a bad marriage. And so you quote the poet Julius Lester, who says, if you live with a writer, you have to accept that there's a part of that person that simply does not belong to you. And it's not personal. In another context, I'd say that's the part that belongs to God.
Yes.
And my one caveat about that is this is true not just of writers, but of everybody, right? There's some part that belongs only to God that we don't have access to.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. I love that quote. And when I first read it, it's like something relaxed inside of me. Because, that chapter... In that chapter about loneliness and marriage, I talk about some of the angst that I feel with, loneliness and how my husband and I have, different worlds in some ways with our vocations and how that makes me feel distant from him sometimes. And when I read that quote, I was like, oh, okay, it's okay to have this part of me that I don't share with him and. Mm-hmm. That I'm unable to share with him and that I don't have time to share with him because it's a whole lot, to try to say it all. I don't know if I want to put anyone through that. But God knows it. And I love how he says that's the part that belongs to God. And, it kind of deepens that idea of how do I belong to God? And, thinking about how these ideas and, desires about my writing life and things I want to write about and things I may never get to write about and books I want to publish and all of the things that I want someone to know and talk to me about and understand and, provide comfort. The idea that belongs to God is very, just kind of relaxes me and helps me know that, that God's there and it's okay if I don't share all of that with a person or my spouse or a friend.
I think it's really helpful to know about whoever we love, our spouses, our kids, our friends. There's just they don't belong to us.
And it's someone told me a long time ago, we want to understand, we want to be understood rather, and the idea that no one will ever fully understand me like accepting that and being like, oh, okay. That's good to know. It's good information to have. But once I became, you know, once I got married, it was even better information to have because, you know, Tim will never fully understand me and I will never fully understand him. And then when my kids came along, it's like, oh, there's another level of, you know, understanding.
There's some other people that won't understand me.
Right. Or, and I won't understand them in some ways. Yeah. And I do think there's a little bit of loneliness in that, but sure. Also, you know, recognizing that truth, again, just kind of gives us freedom to know that, you know, it's okay that we aren't understood all the time.
Yeah. And I think I have this right. I think it's In a River Runs Through It. I may have the wrong book and wrong author, but I'm pretty sure it's Norman McLean's When the River Runs Through It. It talks about the idea that this brother who they never they can't begin to understand. That in the process of having this ununderstandable brother, they had to realize that to love is not the same thing as to understand. You know, that we love people. It's not that you understand them and then you love them. It's that you just love them and you may never understand them.
Right? Wow.
And I think it's such an important insight.
It is.
And I'm sure that now I'm sure that is River Runs Through It. I'm now confident that I'm quoting the right, paraphrasing the right book.
Yeah. And I mean, unfortunately, the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is how, you know, we may have different political views than our parents or siblings mm-hmm. or children and how that's very divisive right now in some ways. But, you know, what does it look like to love even when I don't understand how someone can have that view and they can't understand while I have these views and, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, with regards to politics and loneliness, like that's something I've been really interested in on many levels. I think, political parties give us a sense of belonging, like that we're a part of a bigger team. Mm-hmm. And then it also can create loneliness if we feel like we don't fit in a certain place, which I know a lot of people who don't feel like they fit anywhere in the political landscape. And that's just something I've been interested in lately. It doesn't really have much to do with writing, except that I want to write about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Fair Maybe enough. One day. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, I guess, but we certainly don't have time to get into that. It's something I've been thinking about too, actually.
Yeah.
But what we do have to make time for is the perennial last question of the Habit Podcast. And that is, who are the writers who make you want to write?
Yes. Well, when I first, became a more serious and intentional writer, which was about 10 to 12 years ago, the writers who inspired me, that I had been reading for a few years, maybe more than a few years, who helped me know that I could write the things that I wanted to write about, that I could write honestly about faith and doubt and even the ordinary things of faith and doubt, were Anne Lamott, Kathleen Norris, and Lauren Winter. Mm-hmm. And now, just about everything I read makes me want to write. And that can be very overwhelming. But, you know, for example, I recently finished Claudia Rankine's latest book called Just Us. And I usually read as a writer. Sometimes that can be a hindrance. Sometimes it can be helpful. And sometimes I try to turn that off. But with this book, I was able to read as a writer in ways that were helpful. And I mean, she's a brilliant writer and thinker. And this book was very heavy. Like the object was heavy and there was a lot of white space, which made me think, you know, maybe they were trying to make it heavy. Maybe they were trying to add more pages and, and you know, the subject is also heavy about, you know, race and, looking at things that we may not always notice with regard to race. And, And then the other aspects of the structure were just really interesting to me, the way it was laid out. And so I'm reading this, and I'm not claiming to be a writer, as good of a writer as Claudia Rankine, but I find inspiration from it. Like, what would it look like for me to write a heavy book? If I wrote a heavy book, mm-hmm. what would that topic be? If I already used this kind of structure and layout, like, what could that look like?
Have you decided what your big heavy book would be?
I have some ideas, but yeah. I'm not sharing yet.
Okay.
And then also when I read things that I don't like, I'm like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
this makes me want to write about this in a way that I think it should be written about. And I rarely read something that doesn't make me want to write.
Hmm. You seem to have a strong sense of entering into being a part of the conversation, right? I mean, if everything you read makes you want to write, I can't say that for myself, right? Not everything I read makes me want to write, but when I'm aware that there's a conversation that's been going on for a long time and that I have a voice in that conversation, right? That makes me want to write. Also, it's something when I teach writing, I haven't taught freshman English in a while, but one of the things I used to try to convey in freshman English, college freshman English, was there's a conversation and you can enter into that conversation. This is not just, you're fulfilling this assignment for a grade, but rather people are talking about issues, and you, even though you're whatever you have to say is not in a vacuum. You're responding to somebody, even if you don't think of yourself as responding to something. I think it's really helpful to really think of everything we say as a response to something. I'm here making declarations ex nihilo, but I'm responding to something, and I think that's freeing too.
Yeah, it is, and I love that idea and how. We're entering into a conversation that the people we've read, they've entered into conversation. Like, it goes back. It goes way back.
Yeah, it sure does. It goes all the way back.
It's a very large conversation, a very long conversation. Yeah. And it could just be one sentence from one book mm-hmm. that makes us go, wow, that's interesting. I haven't thought about that. Where did this author get that? And what does that mean to me and my life and things that I'm, interested in and want to flesh out. So,
yeah. Yeah. All right. Charlotte Donlan, thank you so much for being on the Habit Podcast.
Yeah. And, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Yeah. Thanks for continuing the conversation.
Yes.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. Special shout out as well to Jess Ray for letting us use her song Too Good as part of this podcast. Visit jessraymusic.com to hear more of her beautiful songs.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.
This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com, and to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.